Turn on the box.
On Triad this evening, up behind the Triad console, is A.J. Weberman, who is a scientific Dylanologist. He's looking through the, what did you call that?
That's my concordance, my Dylan concordance.
Dylan concordance.
Right now, I'm looking for a particular, the back of another side of Bugland. I looked up the word door, and, see, I think the door means mind in Dylan symbolism. And the reason I think this is because of one particular ambiguous context, which rather isn't that ambiguous, which is on the back of another side of Bob Dylan. Dylan writes, first of all, two people get together and they want to have their doors enlarged, right? They want to have their consciousness expanded. So two more people see what's happening and come to help with the door enlargement. So like the first people who start using consciousness expanding drugs are like greeted by these other people, the hippies, you know, back in 67, who were first out to emerge. The ones that arrive, however, have nothing more to say than let's get these doors enlarged, let's get stoned. To say to the ones who were there in the first place. It follows then that the whole thing revolves around nothing but door enlargement. Third of all, there's a group now existing, and the only thing that keeps them friends is they all want their doors enlarged. He's talking about the emerging drug culture, right? Obviously, the doors are then enlarged. Obviously, they all get together and get stoned.
Then what?
Fourth of all, after this door enlargement, the group has to find something else to keep them together, or else the door enlargement might prove embarrassing. They have to get, you know, they've expanded their consciousness, and they can see what, you know, what's happening to a greater extent than ever before, and they have to act on it. And, take some kind of a political stand,
mm-hmm.
or else the expanded consciousness they receive from using psychedelic sacraments would, you know, won't be really worth anything.
Don't you think it's also looking for a lifestyle, a whole lifestyle, along with...
Right, a lifestyle along with it, but I think the politics are, I think he's referring to politics in this verse, because they, they've gotten into the culture and all that surrounds it, you know, the hair and clothes and, you know, but there's something else. There's, you know, doing something. So Dylan, what Dylan is doing there is predicting the emergence of the Yippies, mm-hmm. or the White Panthers, or, you know, the Provos, or people like that, the, you know, people who mix drugs and politics, so to speak, which is unheard of before Tim Leary.
Speaking of drugs, about 11:30, we'll be hearing from Nicholas Johnson, who's...
Are you going to call him on the phone?
A commissioner on the FCC. No, we have a little program that he put together.
Far out.
And he sent us one, and we'll be hearing about that.
He's about the only decent one on that whole FCC.
It's strange how he's even there.
It is. They're going to get rid of him, soon, no doubt. You know, they want to have, you know, the FCC has this theory that a lot of the current songs are about drugs. Well, if they really knew what was happening, if they'd study it scientifically, they'd find out that most of the songs being written today, in fact, put down drugs, put down heroin. You see,
they do. The majority of songs, those that do mention drugs, are anti-drug songs.
Yeah, because it happens that, you know, like, you know, like Bob Dylan, and Dylan has a tremendous influence on rock people, and they're all aware of Dylan's symbolism, too. They've done these concordances, and whether they did it by computer or in their head, I don't know, but they figured out an awful lot of Dylan's symbolism, and they write songs to Dylan in his own symbolism, putting him down for using heroin, because after 1966, before 1966, when Dylan wrote a ambiguous poem, and you translated it from the Dylanese, it turned into a poem about politics, like Maggie's Farm is American, Subterranean Homesick Blues. Dylan tries to talk to all groups which he feels have potential revolutionary tendencies, like drug users, black people, oppressed white people, poor white people, you know, and some of the more obvious ones are, like that one, Gypsy Davy with a blowtorch, he burns out their camps. Gypsy, it's the black incarnation of Davy Crockett, you know, over in Vietnam with a blowtorch, with a flamethrower, he burns out their camps. With his faithful slave Pedro, with the South Vietnamese behind him, he tramps. With his fantastic collection of stamps, with all his medals, to win friends and influence his uncle, to get better treatment when he returns as a veteran. You know, so when you'd, you translate Dylan's songs, they were all political or, you know,
you think there was
up until
a period?
66.
You're right. There must have been a period that Dylan was more into political type songs.
Right. See, a lot of folk people thought that when he switched to rock music and to very ambiguous lyrics, he had renounced politics and he was doing a bad thing. Well, he really hadn't, because he was still into political thought, as evidenced by the irony in his poetry, although not many people picked up on it. But what Dylan was doing then was even more important. At the time, he was the first freak in the media, you know, you know, he says, I wish I was in some Australian mountain range. He says, I'm bringing it all back home when he was just getting into this. I wish I was on the AM radio, Australian mountain range, AM radio. I got no reason to be there. He's not singing songs like Blowing in the Wind, but I imagine it would be some kind of change. But anything would be a change from Frankie Lame and, you know...
Andy was.
Andy Williams or something. And sure enough, he was, man, with his long hair. He was the first freak. He opened the whole music industry to underground-type people, which now... pretty well dominated, and
dominated. They're there.
They're well. You know, you take a look
they're
at.
They're being exploited along with everyone else.
That's true. That's true. They are, but they're you know, they're still the greatest single force in American music. You know, like you look at Cashbox magazine, you know, through the years as I have done in my research on Dylan, and you see how the people are change over the years. You know, they get more and more freaky. But it's something. Rock is definitely a progressive force in American society, but I don't think it's radical or revolutionary. Maybe it's a liberal force, because as you said, like a lot of the rock performers are merely pawns of their managers and you know, record industry people, you know, and they're just being used. And a lot of them become corrupt in themselves. Like Dylan, for instance, you know, Dylan became rich and famous by exploiting At the time he did it, he wasn't exploiting, but now it sure looks like exploitation. Exploiting the struggle of black people with Blowing in the Wind, exploiting the struggle of poor whites with Hollis Brown and some other songs, and you know, doing concerts for the movement and getting famous this way, right? This is what he used as a springboard to fortune and fame. And now what does Dylan do?
What did he do?
He goes, his lyrics, like Self-Portrait, is totally meaningless, you know, in terms of most people. Like, Self-Portrait, although it's not, Self-Portrait, the reason that Dylan chose specific songs on Self-Portrait was because they fit into his previously constructed network of symbolism. And so when looked at in the context of the rest of Dylan's poetry, songs like Blue Moon and Early Morning Rain turn into songs about heroin. Then he has albums like Nashville Skyline and New Morning, which sing the praises of, middle class life. Buy me a cabin in Utah, marry me a wife, catch a rainbow trout, have a bunch of kids to call me Paul. And everybody gets the idea from Nashville Skyline, or most people get the idea, that Dylan is into a mellow head, and he's decided that the only way to really enjoy life is to escape somewhere and cut yourself off from it all. So that's what he does. His lyrics are like really terrible. And then what does he do with his money? Dylan, the same cat who wrote Masters of War, an indictment of munitions manufacturers, bought $20,000 worth of Ling Temco Voigt around 1968. Ling Temco Voigt is a large American corporation that manufactures munitions for use in Vietnam. 3 months ago, he invested $250,000 in a Times Square office building along with Johnny Carson. He takes money from the hip community and gives it to the straights. Now, if Dylan, it wouldn't be so bad if Dylan would be honest about it and bill himself as Bob Dylan, the singing real estate broker.
Change his name.
Right, well, he's changed his name back to Zimmerman.
Oh, yes.
Legally, yeah. That's what he told me the last time I saw him.
What happened when
Well, first of all, in order to talk to Dylan, like, he knew I had insight into his poetry. He knew how much I dug him. He knew I totally devoted my whole life to him. And yet, when I went around to see him, he says, "Al, don't come around my house anymore." You know, so I split, you know, and then he lives about 10 blocks from me. You know, I live on the Bowery, he lives in the best part of the village. But we're pretty close together, that's the way New York is. And so one day, I happened to be walking to the Cafe Gaslight to see, I think, Doug Kershaw. And passing by, and I saw Dylan's house, and I said, he won't let me in, the jerk, you know. And then I looked at his garbage can, and I said, well, he won't let me in there, right? But there's something in that can over there that was once inside there. So I went over to the garbage can, I reached in, and I pulled out this letter, and it said, "Dear John and June, won't be in Nashville this summer, won't be in Nashville this month, but we're sending this letter along with, Jane to tell you how we feel." And I said, wow, this isn't a garbage can, it's a gold mine, you know. And so after that night, I made daily pickups of Dylan's garbage, you know. And pretty soon he got suspicious. He said, something is happening with my garbage, and I don't know what it is. So he hired somebody to watch his garbage, you know, to guard his garbage. And you know, he was thinking of calling the police, but they said, no, you better not do it. This is what Weberman wants, give the publicity he wants. And so they just started taking all the good stuff out of the garbage and leaving me with dog's excrement. And he censored his garbage, right? And so, so then I decided, well, how am I going to get to see Dylan? Well, at the time I was teaching a course in Dylanology, going over all these interpretations with people at the Alton University in New York. And we'd been studying Dylan for about 10 weeks in a course called Elementary Dylanology, since we hadn't really gotten into the heavy stuff yet.
101.
Yeah, 103. One night we said, well, let's do some field work in Dylanology. Let's go over and see where Bob Dylan lives, because the place was also close to, ultimately, it was also close to Dylan's house. So we all went over to McDougal Street, and I started to go through Dylan's garbage, you know, just for old time's sake. I know there'd nothing would be in it. So then we started yelling, "Hey, Bobby, come on out, Bobby. Your fans want to see you," you know. And I never expected to come out in a million years. But sure enough, I was just in the middle of looking at our good a can of tomato sauce, empty can of tomato sauce, when somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, "There's somebody across the street who looks just like Dylan." I says, "Oh no, he's caught me red-handed going through his garbage, you know, and he's a karate expert, you know. This is gonna be a bit heavy." So Dylan says, "Al, what'd you bring all these people around my house for?" And I says, "Well, man, it's a field trip for my Dylan class. But actually, it's a demonstration against all you've come to represent in rock." So he took me by the arm, and we went around the corner, and we talked for a while. And then he called me up that night and offered me a job as his chauffeur. You know, I says, "Bob, you trying to buy me out, man?" He says, "No, Al, I wouldn't do that. I just want you to see life from another seat. You've been on the streets too long." So I said, "Uh-uh, man, I don't want any job as your chauffeur. I want you to use your influence to do something good, you know, or use your money, man, to, like, repay the people who made you famous." And Dylan says, "Well, let's talk about this some more tomorrow." And he took me over to his studio, and then he offered me all these things if I'd only stop, you know, going around saying that his poetry is about heroin. He offered me rare pictures. He offered me rare tapes. He offered to enhance my career as a rock critic by giving me interviews that right after his album came out and letting me sit down in recording sessions. He offered me all these things, but by that time I was so far gone into yippie politics that I told him to you know what with it. And not only that, I talked to him a couple of other times, and finally I wrote up our conversation as an interview, which was subsequently published in Rolling Stone and East Village Other.
That was A.J. Weberman.